Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, one of the most distinguished writers in architecture speaks about one of the foremost practitioners of the art. As Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic Paul Goldberger joins us today to discuss the work of Frank Gehry. According to a panel of 50 architects, critics, and historians put together by Vanity Fair magazine, Gehry is thought to be the most important architect in the world. His design, from his own exploded Santa Monica home to the Guggenheim Bilbao, the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles, and his new shimmering high-rise in Lower Manhattan, have transformed contemporary architecture through the use of imaginative and computer-designed surfaces and spaces. Paul Goldberger has spent a career writing about architecture as the critic for the New York Times, where he won the Pulitzer Prize for criticism, now as a contributing editor of Vanity Fair. He's the author of books like Why Architecture Matters, Building Up and Tearing Down, and Up from Zero. His first biography and latest book is titled Building Art, The Life and Work of Frank Gehry, and is published by Knopf. Paul Goldberger, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. Very few architects and their works ever avoid a period where they fall out of favor or receive lots of criticism or even face destruction. But when you look at Frank Gehry's best work, he seems to, so far, to have avoided that. Do you think they're going to stand the test of time, the great buildings, the Guggenheim Bilbao, Walt Disney Concert Hall, some right. of his high-rises?
Yeah, I think they will, actually. I think his career has been unusual in that it's had a kind of very gradual arc. And he didn't burst onto the scene and become famous when he was 25. He was over 50 when he began to be a notable figure. He was in his 60s when the Guggenheim Bilbao was built. And he's been sort of building gradually over time very successfully. And the great buildings that he's done, I think, will last the test of time. There may be some ups and downs in their reputation because that always happens. But I think they're important buildings for the long haul in architectural culture.
Do you think because he became the Starkitect, as you refer to in the book, in his 50s, that we're going to see these as his mature works, that he's worked out the problems earlier in his career that sort of plague a young architect in their buildings? They may be audacious, but they might have functionality
sure.
problems or practicality problems.
Well, he's always been pushing the envelope, though. You know, he's always pushing to do new things. He's 86 and a half right now. He's still taking on new work and doing different things. So he's always wanted to be at the cutting edge and always wanted to experiment. In fact, Bilbao is a mature building in one sense. That's the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain. But in another way, it represented something completely new because it was a building done almost entirely with digital software, digital technology. Couldn't have been all those crazy shapes could never have been actually fabricated and engineered without digital technology. So it's a building very much of its moment, too.
And this is one of the interesting things about when you talk about the digital software, which has been used to build many of these buildings that we associate with Gehry.
Sure.
He said that this digital software has freed the architect to be more like an artist in many ways.
Yes, he very much wants that to be the case. He very much wants the architect, again, to kind of get control of the process of building, which now, you know, big buildings are so complicated now that they're not just contractors and architects. There are construction managers and all kinds of other bureaucratic layers in between. And if it's a government project, there's even more bureaucratic layers. And he feels that, in fact, actually one of the advantages of digital software is that it can give the architect a kind of renewed sense of control by making absolutely certain that things will come out a certain way, allowing you to gauge pricing, cost, much more effectively, to make changes in a way that's efficient. You can immediately know whether this change will or will not have this or this effect on a project, and so forth. So it takes a huge amount of guesswork out of the construction process.
Well, in writing this book, Building Art, The Life and Work of Frank Gehry, you've been covering him for many years. You're very familiar with his work and very
right.
familiar with him. Why the decision to write the book, and what was the most interesting thing you learned about him in the process?
Well, I decided to write the book partly because I've always been fascinated by him and his work, but also as an architecture critic, I've spent my life writing about people's work. I've never actually written about someone's life, and so the idea of writing a biography as a new genre, as a way of, for me as a writer, it's like exercising different muscles, you might say, you know, but I could still make use of a lifetime of thinking about architecture. So I think the most interesting thing I learned was that his creativity really is a source of constant anxiety for him. Even though he's proud of what he's accomplished, he never quite feels it's good enough. He never quite feels he's gotten it right. He still feels he wants to keep pushing. And while I don't want to make this sound like simple armchair psychotherapy, so to speak, you know, he had a very difficult relationship with his father, who he always wanted to please, who died before he saw any of Frank's successful buildings. And there's this sense somehow of always wanting to please somebody that he's never quite gotten over, even in his 80s, as possibly the most successful architect in the world.
And yet he's certainly his own man. And he
very
also,
much.
What I found was really interesting was he has this ability to step away from projects or people he doesn't want to necessarily work with, or he steps away from projects and people that are so big. Most architects, I think, wouldn't and couldn't step away from, you know,
right.
They couldn't say no to, basically.
Yeah. That's another thing I learned, actually, in the course of it, was that there actually is a pattern with him that began all the way back in childhood of walking away from situations that could have been of huge benefit to him, but he felt something wasn't quite right, or he felt he was losing control of what was going on in some way. You know, he walked away from what would have been his first skyscraper, the headquarters for the New York Times in New York, an incredibly important building, because he just didn't feel at the very beginning of the process that things were going right, and they wanted him to commit to being in New York every week at a meeting, and it was very bureaucratic and very rigid, and he thought, you know, maybe this is just more like an ordinary corporation than this great newspaper I've always been reading my whole life, and maybe I'm idealizing them too much, and maybe we're actually not going to be in sync enough. And he said, no, thank you, and walked away, even though it would have been possibly the biggest, most important building he would have done up to that point. And similarly, early in his career, he had this amazing set of designs for furniture made of cardboard.
Right.
Became a huge hit, briefly. And Bloomingdale's department store featured it. It was written about all over the place. It was on its way to becoming the hottest trend in the home interior design business, and he just decided, no, this is not going right, and the investors were trying to turn it too much into a regular company, and he was not going to be able to artistically do what he wanted, and he walked away from that as well.
It's funny you mentioned the furniture design, because that's still very highly sought even today in the design market. The
yes.
Easy Edge furniture, the bent wood chairs, the Gary Fish
right.
lamp.
Right. Well, some of those things came later, of course,
yeah.
when he began to be more comfortable with that idea. Some of the early things that were done years ago are actually very valuable, and you can find them almost as really like antiques. A couple of those other furniture things have been reissued by some other companies and are now actually kind of standard. There's a thing called the Wiggle Chair that
right.
that is now manufactured new, but comes out of those years of early design from a long time ago.
And again, made out of cardboard. And cardboard has been an important material in his... you wouldn't think for an architect that wants to create things to last that cardboard would, but it's been an important material in his life.
Yes, it has. It has. He's done a lot of things with cardboard and a lot of other ordinary, inexpensive materials. I think he built his reputation originally trying to make serious architecture out of ordinary stuff. Corrugated metal, chain-link fencing he became very famous for, plywood, and also often making 2x4 framework that he would kind of leave exposed. You know, he said once that when he was growing up, or rather in his early years in Los Angeles, he was born in Toronto, but his early years in Los Angeles, when the city was really growing rapidly in the 1950s, he would see all these tract housing developments go up alongside the new freeways, and they looked best when they were just the frames of all the houses, the wooden frames. And then when they first covered them with the exterior and finished them, they looked awful. And so he always remembered that look of that framework and has tried to recapture some of that in some of his work.
We began our conversation by saying, you know, he's an architect when his best work that seems to be accepted immediately and so far has shown no sign of a subsiding of the popularity. But his own home in Santa Monica, where he used a lot of these techniques, probably has more criticism than any other place.
Well, it certainly did early on because it looked so bizarre to a lot of people. He bought an old Dutch colonial house in Santa Monica, pleasant suburban kind of neighborhood of no real distinction, and then started altering it by building all this crazy stuff around it, these unusual shapes and, again, corrugated metal and chain-link fencing and sort of things that would come out at strange angles. And it was really quite an amazing thing to behold, and especially because the old house remained, and you could see it kind of popping up in the middle with all this other stuff around it. And so it really became a kind of metaphor for almost like a generational struggle between new and old, which you could say maybe is what sort of houses sometimes are and family life inside them sometimes is. But and the neighbors generally hated it. Now it's been there for 40 years, and it's become so well-known and so established that, you know, you see tourists go by to look at it and photograph it from the outside and even buses sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the cool thing to me is it's almost like there's this contemporary house trying to explode.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
And that's sort of a theme in his some of his works, too, where it's like you see these forms and it's almost like they're exploding. And you use that term for things like the Louis Vuitton Foundation building, which is, depending on where you're looking at it, it looks like this enormous Leviathan whale or a ship.
Very much like a ship from a lot of angles, yes. The thing that I think is important to remember about Frank Gehry's work is that it's not about chaos and making messes of things. The astonishing thing about most of these buildings is that, in fact, they have a kind of unexpected serenity to them. I mean, he wants people to feel comfortable in his buildings. That was something else I really understood more as I got to know him better and understand the mind, the creative mind behind all of this stuff. He wants people to be comfortable. He wants you, in a way, to be as comfortable as you might be in a traditional colonial house or Georgian house or something. He just wants to show you that there's a different route to that comfort and that things can be different and yet still nurturing in a certain way. But they can be exciting and comfortable at the same time and different and comfortable at the same time. But his goal is not to shock people more than anything else. It's to find a different route to comfort. And similarly, at, say, Walt Disney Concert Hall in downtown Los Angeles, that is really all about making the experience of going to a live concert exciting in a way it once was and not boring, as it all too often has been in our time.
And what I love about that concert hall is it echoes a lot of the old traditions of Europe in the actual concert hall, except it has this wonderful sense of California relaxation that's a part of it.
Yes,
and yet
absolutely.
The building is iconic from the outside. It gathers people's attention. It makes it an exciting experience to go to a concert. Yet it's this combination of this old world sort of what Europe has done many times, which is put actually the audience as close to the performers as they can and sometimes right behind the stage where you're seeing from different angles. That's a very European tradition, which we've never really done in this country until recently.
Right, although now others have followed it.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. And today, you know, remember today, everybody who carries an iPod or an iPhone has access to music of a quality that the most expensive, elaborate stereo system a generation ago couldn't have produced. So we will carry all that around in our pockets. Go to a live concert, there has to be something yet again even more special, or why bother? And so, you know, we're long past the days when the only way you could really hear great music was by getting out of your house and getting into the car and going to a concert hall. So how do you make the experience of live music exciting and meaningful? And he's really done that at Walt Disney Concert Hall, which I think is possibly the best public building of the last generation in America. Anywhere, not just the best music hall. But you're absolutely right that there is a quality, even though nothing looks like a traditional concert hall, when you get inside and sit in your seat, there is this sense of enveloping comfort that one associates with a very traditional concert hall or opera house, even though, you know, he doesn't use red velvet, he doesn't use gold curlicues, he doesn't have any of those traditional elements. He's seeking a new way to bring you to that same place.
Well, the interior looks utterly Californian in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's actually all wood, and it's like
right.
You're also inside a great wood instrument in some ways, too.
My guest today is Paul Goldberger, contributing editor at Vanity Fair, former architect critic at the New York Times. His new book is titled Building Art, The Life and Work of Frank Gehry, which, you know, for a while he was famous for his, and still is, for his public buildings, the Guggenheim Bilbao, the Walt Disney Concert Hall. But he's constantly looking for new ways of expressions, high-rises, buildings that that have become iconic most in many of the communities where they're built. You spent only a page on the Dancing House, the Fred and Ginger in Prague, but that's become a symbol for that
yes.
community.
And it's a fabulous building, too. I spent only a page on it, not because I didn't like it, but just because I was afraid if you know, he's done so much interesting work, if every single project got described in detail, the book would be too long for anybody to read, and I didn't want to, you know, this is a book very much for general readers, not for architects. It's about a life, and not just about the architecture, and about how these things connect. So that meant it just wasn't possible to go into real detail on every interesting project.
Now, you do spend quite a bit of time on the building of the Walt Disney Concert Hall, because
yes.
it was a soap opera in and of itself.
Absolutely, yes. That's probably the best term I could use for it, is soap opera.
Yeah. Why was this building so difficult to get built?
It was an unusual building. You know, he won a competition to design it. There was a lot of dispute over whether that was back in the day when he was still known as kind of the funky Los Angeles architect who did crazy things like make buildings out of plywood and chain link fencing. And the thought that he could do a concert hall was considered a little weird by a lot of people. So there was a lot of antagonism. The building was complicated. It was very ambitious for him. And it was a client. The client was the city, the county, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and an overall cultural entity called the L.A. Music Center. And first they were all fighting among each other. And then they had this sort of unusual architect. They were afraid that the building would be too complicated to build normally, and they said, well, you need an associate architect who can actually do the real construction documents and drawings. And because we don't think, it was essentially like saying, we need to get a grown-up architect to babysit you. And he said, oh, no. And they said, yes, yes, yes. And so finally he agreed. It turned out that he understood a lot of the technical things better than the so-called grown-up architect did. And a lot of time was lost in that process, and the construction drawings turned out not to be very good and not to be usable, and the whole project ground to a halt for a while. Meanwhile, the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, was being built, and it went very smoothly, very successfully, with Frank Gehry's office in charge of everything, and was opened in 1997 at a time when Disney Hall was stalled, and everyone was hailing it as the most important new building in the world. So the civic leaders of Los Angeles found themselves in a bit of an embarrassing quandary. You know, here is this dinky little town in Spain that can build a building by Frank Gehry and be hailed by everyone around the world for having this masterwork. Meanwhile, here in his hometown of Los Angeles, we can't seem to get this building off the ground, so we'd better do something. So a campaign was started to kind of reignite the building, and he got control of it again, and the babysitter architect was let go, and it was turned over eventually entirely to his firm and got finished, yeah. to also great acclaim. But it was a soap opera. I've just told you a very, very, very simplified version of it. There was all kinds of other amazing things that happened.
And yet, this is the time where he didn't step away from a project which probably normally he probably would have.
Right. He came very close to walking away in 1994 when it ground to a halt. And he was so unhappy being in Los Angeles that he considered moving his office because he felt he was a pariah in his hometown.
Wow.
And he looked into other places in New York and other places on the East Coast, thought about maybe even going to Europe. And what he did do, in the end he didn't move at all, but it was a time when he was beginning to get a lot of other work around the world, and he said yes to almost anything. I mean, if someone had called him and asked him to do a kitchen in Budapest, he probably would have done it, because he was so happy to have an excuse to get on a plane and not be in Los Angeles those years. And, of course, much of the travel was for the Guggenheim in Bilbao, Spain, which was a very real project and a very important one. And he kept moving, and eventually things got restarted in Los Angeles, and he and Los Angeles lived more or less happily ever after.
So they have reconciled.
They have reconciled, yes. More than reconciled, actually. Just a couple of weeks ago, he got the J. Paul Getty Foundation, which runs, you know, the Getty Museum there, has an award they call the Getty Medal that they give to a distinguished figure in the arts, not necessarily an architect. And they gave it to him this year. So it was a great, and the mayor and the head of the Getty and the conductor of the New York Philharmonic were all the people who presented it to him.
Now, you opened the book with probably his best-known high-rise, which was completed not very long ago, and that's 8 Spruce Street. This is a remarkable building. It's almost like it's built to shimmer.
Yes, that's a good way to put it, actually, built to shimmer. I wish I'd thought of that when I wrote the book. It's a nice line.
But it is a gorgeous building.
And it does shimmer. It's a high-rise that, in fact, seems to undulate as it goes up and down, and it looks amazing in the sunlight as the morning and evening sun hits it at the right angles. It's in Lower Manhattan, and the thing that is most important about that building to him, I think, is not, though, the unconventional exterior of it with this beautiful rippling stainless steel facade that he likened to the folds in a Bernini sculpture of sort of fabric. If you think about how those sculptures of the Renaissance in Italy, so beautifully sculpted flowing fabric, that was his inspiration for the tower. But the interior of it, which is relatively conventional, and it has a core with elevators and apartment layouts around it and hallways and so forth, that is not particularly unusual. And he felt very strongly and feels very strongly at this point in his career that he wants to prove that he can do commercial buildings and not just one-off special things like the Guggenheim in Bilbao or the Walt Disney Concert Hall, that he can also do things that a commercial developer will make money from, that he can do more distinctively but with the same economics, so that the builder will actually be willing to do it, as opposed to saying, nice idea, but go away. So he's very proud of that building because of its ordinary innards as much as because of its extraordinary exterior. And showing that he can actually combine these things and use digital software to make that all possible.
You know, what's really interesting to me is he's really the true artist mentality, which is he could have made a great career building concert halls. I mean, right. He's done a lot of concert halls. He seems to have this understanding of acoustics, which is just as important as the eye candy of the building. And he's done it for everywhere from the Hollywood Bowl to the Concord Pavilion to Walt Disney Concert Hall to Miami to other places,
yes.
Or museums where, again, his work is flashy, but it doesn't detract from the art on the walls.
I don't believe it does, no.
Yeah. And yet he's always looking for a new challenge and a new area of architecture to succeed in.
Yes, absolutely right. He's always interested in pushing in some new direction, doesn't want to be typed with any particular kind of building, and is also more and more interested in just other ways in which an architect can bring his expertise to the benefit of a community in some way. You know, he's doing now in Los Angeles two really interesting projects, both pro bono, both for no fee. One is a center for children with mental health problems in Watts, in the poor community of Watts. And the other is a study about what to do with the Los Angeles River, which is a 51-mile-long, mainly concrete culvert.
Yeah, ditch at times.
And trying to sort of help turn it into some sort of recreation space and some other kind of thing. Both of those projects actually are since the book, so they're not in the book. The other day I mentioned that to him, and he said, well, you could just do volume 2. I love the idea of a guy who's close to 87 thinking enough about the future so that there could be a volume 2.
One of the things I enjoyed about the book was learning about some of the projects I didn't know about.
Sure.
And one I really loved was the Loyola Law School, which looks like a utterly modern version of a Canaletto painting.
Wow, yeah, I think that's right. And I think, actually, I think Frank Gehry would probably love what you said, because he is, in fact, extremely attuned to and inspired by Renaissance architecture and art. He just doesn't want to show his fondness by imitating it directly, by mimicking it, but rather by taking those ideas and seeing how can you reinterpret them in a language of our time in a different way, but very much in sync with all that stuff. I'm glad you like Loyola, because that's actually one of my favorites as well, which is why, even though it's not that well-known a project, it got a lot of attention, because it was also where he kind of developed ideas and where he began to move to another scale, played with some other things, with the idea of public buildings and public space and making a little kind of town square in the middle of this complex of buildings. It was a very important building in his development, and it's still a really lovely little project.
I want to ask one last question with your architecture critic hat on. And, you know, every architect has buildings that didn't get built for one reason or another. What is your Gehry building you would have loved to have seen built that didn't proceed or seems to be permanently stalled at this point?
There's one that I think is maybe referred to in the book, but I don't think we had a picture of it. A wonderful project that was going to be a headquarters for the Screen Actors Guild, I think, and office building somewhere in Hollywood that looked like a little Italian hill town of little buildings all inside a sort of huge metal frame, is all I can describe it. So it sort of looked as if it almost looked like a picture. And it was the most interesting combination of sort of picturesqueness and practicality, given the nature of the site and also what Hollywood is about and so forth. It was a brilliant play on a whole lot of ideas. That's one I always wished had happened. Of course, you know, there's new stuff continuing to happen and continuing to be designed. So he seems to show no sign of wanting to slow down.
Well, you know, the thing about it is like a Frank Lloyd Wright building still go up 30 years or 40, 50 years after his death. Do you think the same will be true with Gehry?
Actually, I hope that doesn't happen because in fact, usually posthumous buildings aren't the best idea. architects, often, you know, and with Gehry in particular, he keeps tweaking and playing with his things until the very last minute. And even after they're built, I've seen him look at things and say, gee, I kind of wish I'd done this like this and wish I'd... He's never 100% satisfied with anything. And so I think the thought that one of his designs would be frozen and then built many years after his death, with him having no opportunity to go back right before construction and start tweaking it again and playing with it a little more, would probably frustrate him.
Yeah. The name of the book is Building Art, The Life and Work of Frank Gehry. Paul Goldberger, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Goldberger is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine. He's the author of numerous books on architecture and former architecture critic for the New York Times. His latest book is titled Building Art, The Life and Work of Frank Gehry. It's published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Look for Studio Tulsa, and you can search through our archives and listen on demand. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.